Mr. Richards.
Thank you. May it please the court. Mr. Wynn and I represent Mr. David Luttrell. Mr. Luttrell was convicted of felony DWI and was sentenced by a jury to 18 years confinement in Texas Department of Criminal Justice. The punishment range in this case, the upper range, was 20 years, so the jury sentenced him very close to the maximum punishment. And as this court is aware, 18 years for a felony DWI is a substantial sentence for a jury to hand down, not an insignificant sentence. Mr. Wynn is going to address point of error number one, and I will address point of error two. Point of error two deals with a closing jury argument made by the prosecution. I think it's going to be important for this court, when it goes to address this issue, to kind of diagram the prior criminal history in this case, because it's very confusing. The record is very confusing because the prosecutors made several errors during the presentation of the case in chief, and then they kind of compounded those mistakes during the punishment jury argument, to where it appeared that Mr. Luttrell, in fact, had sixth conviction, when in fact it was his fifth conviction. And actually, part of the jury argument could be interpreted as that there were actually seven convictions. There, in fact, were not. And Mr. Wynn and I appreciate the fact that the state has conceded that the prosecutors made mistakes. However, the state contends on appeal that those mistakes were not significant, and they didn't have any impact on the jury's sentence. I'll get to that issue in a moment. But the jury argument in question refers at first to the proper sequence of the misdemeanor convictions, and then it goes completely out of sequence and refers to Mr. Luttrell being out on bond in April of 2006 for a DWI offense. In fact, he was not arrested and charged until June of 2006. He was not out on bond. He had not been under arrest in April of 2006. And that is the subject, and this issue was preserved. There were a number of issues that weren't preserved related to this kind of mismatch and inaccuracy of the prior convictions, but this error was definitely preserved by Mr. Factor. Here's the argument. The prosecutor begins by making correct statements. She says, then in 1991, he got a second DWI, and it was a misdemeanor level. Before this case was disposed of, when it was still pending, the defendant was out on bond. The next year, 1992, he picked up another DWI, number three.
Which page are you on? On the wrong page, obviously.
On the record...
Are you in your brief?
I'm on the state's brief. I'm using the state's. Page 11 of the state's brief. And then the state went on to say, in 2006, his first DWI... Well, that was a misstatement. The state meant to say 2000, okay? There was no objection, so there was no error there. And she says it should have been 1992, but it wasn't. And here's where the error occurs. She says, so in April of 2006, he gets arrested for driving while intoxicated. He bonds out again while he's out on bond. That's a misstatement. And here's the objection that Mr. Factor makes. I object, Your Honor. That's outside the record. There's no testimony he was on bond during any of these periods. And any of these periods clearly went to, at least in part, that last statement of the prosecutor. He was not on bond in April of 2006. Again, he wasn't arrested in 2006. His only arrest in 2006 occurred in June of 2006. So that was a misstatement by the prosecutor. The judge says overruled, and then the prosecutor says, and while on bond, he picks up another DWI in December of 2006. That's again a mistake. He was never arrested in 2006 in December. The only arrest in 2006 was in June of 2006. But Mr. Factor did not make an objection to that particular statement. So the only issue that we have preserved for appellate review is the statement referring to the arrest and bond in April of 2006. And that clearly was properly preserved. Now, the state makes the argument, first of all, the state, and again, I appreciate their willingness to say all of these references to 2006 were intended to be references to what happened in the year 2000. And I think that's fairly clear from the record, but again, I appreciate the state willingness to admit that. But I don't agree with the state's analysis then. The state says the argument was permissible because it was a reasonable summation of the evidence, because it was referring to the year to what happened in the year 2000. Well, I would agree if they were talking about the year 2000, that would be a reasonable summation of the evidence. But she wasn't referring to 2000. She was referring to the year 2006. So that was a clearly improper argument. It was not a reasonable deduction from the evidence. The state says, well, even if it was error, it's got to be disregarded because it didn't affect the appellant's substantial rights. Substantial rights, then the state goes through the analysis, but then the state arrives at the wrong conclusion. First of all, the severity of the misconduct, the prejudicial effect of the prosecutor's remarks. The state says that benefits, that particular factor should be interpreted in favor of the state, because although they got the years wrong, in effect, they had the sequence right, the correct sequence. They didn't. And if you look at actually Page as proof of that, the state indicates in their brief that the state proved there were six convictions. They didn't prove that. They only proved that there were five. The state has itself on appeal become confused by the prosecutor's remarks in the trial court. The June 2006 was the fifth conviction, not the sixth. And the only way you arrive at the conclusion that there were six convictions is through this kind of improper belief that either in April of 2006 or in December of 2006, the appellant was arrested again. And that is clearly not correct. They say the curative measures taken by the trial court. Well, the trial court overruled the objection. There was no curative measure. So that factor clearly weighs in favor of the defense. Finally, the certainty of punishment absent misconduct. The state says, well, the jurors didn't give him the maximum. The jurors gave him 18 years. Well, that doesn't favor the state. 18 years is a significant sentence, and only because it was not the maximum, only under that theory does the state contend that that factor benefits the state. And then the state goes on to admit that the state believes that there were six convictions shown when there were only five. So if the state is confused by this record and by the prosecutor's jury argument, the insinuations that there were arrests in April of 2006 and December of 2006, surely the jury could have been confused. And Mr. Factor's objection should have been sustained.
Let me ask you a quick question. Was the evidence, the correct evidence presented before the jury, in verbal or documentary form or both?
The correct evidence, well, the evidence about what happened in 2006 was, 2000 was properly before the jury. The evidence
verbally or in documented or
no? For the year 2000, the evidence, I believe, was documented. All of the references that were inaccurate were verbal in nature that occurred during the trial. First, during the presentation of the evidence by the state on cross-examination of one of the defendant's witnesses, and then during jury argument.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. One, and I realize I'm eating at the Reagan's time.
Yeah, you are. So the jury had the hard copy that showed all the 2000 stuff. So when the state, are you saying that when the state starts talking about the 2006 stuff, the jury thought this was on top of all that 2000
yes,
stuff?
Exactly.
Okay.
And even the state mistakenly believes that on appeal. That's the only way you get to six convictions. Finally, on the state's argument that somehow this error was waived because Mr. Factor didn't object when the same evidence came in a second time, the same evidence didn't come in a second time. There was a reference by the prosecutor to April of 2006, an arrest while out on bond. There was an objection. That objection was overruled. Then the prosecutor talked about an arrest in December of 2006. Mr. Factor did not object to that, but that was a completely separate incident, December of 2006, not April of 2006. So the issue that we're complaining about on appeal was preserved by Mr. Factor, and that same evidence did not come in subsequently. It was a reference to a different offense. And although it was wrong, there was no objection, and that particular misstatement by the prosecutor is not the subject of the complaint on appeal. Thank you.
I'm going to move pretty quickly. I want to draw two distinctions between the argument that Mr. Richards just made and the argument I'm going to make. First off, the issue in point of error one is about a guilt-innocence phase jury argument. It's not just limited to the punishment phase. Second, the issue in point of error one is a constitutional issue. It is about placing a condition on the exercise of the defendant's right to remain silent. And because of that, it is reviewed under constitutional harm analysis, which means that you have to find beyond a reasonable doubt it was harmless, rather than finding that it affected Mr. Luttrell's substantial rights. With that in mind, and it's set out in both the state's brief and our brief, the state's jury argument, they're talking about him, the video of the defendant refusing to perform field sobriety tests. And what they argue is, did you see the defendant that night? He's hoping you will give him a free pass. Objection overruled, which we would argue is a judicial stamp of approval on the argument. The state then repeats the argument. He's hoping you will give him a free pass. Objection overruled again. This comment can do... The only person who could explain what Mr. Luttrell was hoping on that videotape is him, and he did not testify. It is therefore either a direct comment on his failure to testify, or at a bare minimum, an indirect failure on his comment to testify, because he was the only person who could supply the contradictory evidence for what his substantial hopes were. Now, the state's basic response to this is that, well, it's a reasonable inference from the evidence. And I would submit to you that in every case the defendant doesn't testify, it would be a reasonable deduction from what has gone on in the courtroom that there's some reason he didn't testify, and that reason is because he's guilty. But a jury is specifically told, or should be specifically told, there are certain inferences they're simply not allowed to make. Whether it is relevant, rational, or otherwise, for legal reasons, they're not allowed to make that inference. And in this particular case, the one inference that they could not draw from what was presented to them was that the defendant was somehow hoping the jury would give him a free pass because he did not testify to say what his hopes were. I would also point out that if you think about it in terms of just basic evidentiary principles, who is the one person who can testify to what the defendant's hopes are? If the defense had put some witness up there to say, well, David didn't take the field sobriety test because, it wouldn't have been admissible. It would have all been it would either have been speculative or hearsay. So the only person who can supply that information is the defendant. The other thing I would point out, and this is not in our brief, it's something that I was tossing around in my head and I did some research. I came across a case called Modi, M-O-D-Y, v. State. That's 2 Southwest 3rd, 652. It's a Court of Appeals, Houston 14th Court of Appeals case, and it cites a Court of Criminal Appeals case called Hardy, H-A-R-D-I-E, which is at 807 Southwest 2nd, 319. These are cases about breath test refusals, which, as you know, are statutorily admissible. But it's very interesting because in Hardy, what the Court of Criminal Appeals said, it was the inverse of our case. In Hardy, the defense said, the evidence of the refusal should not be admissible because it's not relevant. Because unless you know why the defendant refused, it doesn't. There's no logical link to make it relevant and admissible in court. And the Court of Criminal Appeals said no. A breath test refusal is admissible without evidence of why the defendant refused. Well, then when you get to the Modi case, what Modi says is not only is it admissible without it, but under the statute, the defendant's reason for refusal to take a breath test is not relevant to the state's case. In fact, evidence of why a breath test was refused is technically irrelevant and inadmissible in the state's case. And they cite Hardy for that proposition. And I think they did not go into the analysis, but the reason that it's irrelevant in the state's case is because of the Fifth Amendment. It's because no one can explain that other than the defendant. And if you read Hardy and Modi, what they both say is the defendant can put it on. The defendant can get on the stand and say, I didn't take the breath test because I don't trust the machine or my lawyer told me to or whatever, to explain why it was. And then, of course, the state can argue, no, you didn't take the test because you were drunk.
All right, Counselor, you've expired.
Sorry, Your Honor.
It's all right.
I have one question, though. Where do we plug the Texas Constitution into all of this that says a defendant cannot be compelled not to testify against himself, but to provide evidence against himself? Is that something we consider other than the Fifth Amendment that, you know, you can't comment on a defendant's invoking his right to remain silent because that's a constitutionally provided right. Can you comment on a defendant's invoking the state constitutional right to be not to be required to provide any evidence against himself?
I have two responses to that. First off, it wasn't preserved below and we haven't briefed it, so I don't know that we get to make that argument here. Secondly, I think that that is a valid argument, but I also think that the Court of Criminal Appeals has interpreted the statutes making breath test refusals admissible as constitutional, and in so doing, I think the Court of Criminal Appeals has effectively told us that despite the differing language between the Texas Constitution and the United States Constitution on this issue, this is one of those times when the Texas Constitution means the same thing that the United States Constitution does.
But I meant the field sobriety test. Is that the same as a breath test?
No, it's not, and I'm not, because there's no statutory predicate for admissibility on it.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Ms. Messerly?
May it please the Court. I'm Shelley Messerly, as you know, representing the state. I'm going to go ahead and start out with my response to Mr. Richards' argument.
You may want to pull the mic down a little bit.
Oh, can you hear me? Okay.
Enter.
To the second point of error. I agree with Mr. Richards that there appears to be a date that was misspoken in closing argument. But first I'd like to clarify, based on a question that you asked, Judge Dauphineau. You asked Mr. Richards if the jury was basing their punishment, or if they were led to believe that this particular defendant was convicted of all of these prior convictions, including the 2006. And if you look at the state's closing argument, you will see that we did not argue about 2000 convictions he received in 2000 and convictions he received in 2006. We only argued, unfortunately, about a 2006 conviction. I agree with Mr. Richard. There was not a December 2006 conviction. However, there was a December 2000 conviction. If you go back and you look at the cross-examination of one of the witnesses during the punishment phase, you see that one of our prosecutors, Christy Jack, was talking to this particular witness about this defendant's priors and talks about December 2000. A few lines later, a few questions later, she inadvertently says 2006. The defense didn't object to that, and unfortunately that error was carried through closing argument. However, we didn't argue that he had additional convictions in regard to the 2000. I just wanted to clarify that.
Did defense counsel correct any of these errors during its opportunity during closing?
No. None of the errors were corrected. Not during the cross-examination, not during the closing argument, and actually, Mr. Richards' brief, he referred to the conviction as a December 2006 conviction. I wanted to point out also, if you look at the defense's amended brief and you look at footnote number 2, it says, although it is of no direct consequence to the issues presented on appeal, appellant has tendered this amended brief to address a mistake made by the parties in allowing the jury inaccurate information concerning appellant's criminal history. And you can go on to read that their inaccuracy concerned this 2006 arrest. Also in his brief, I wanted to point out on page 13, the very first line at the top of the page, he says, to be clear, appellant's contention here is not that there was no evidence in the record of a December 2006 DW arrest, and he was also meaning a December 2000 arrest. There was testimony of an arrest, although that testimony was inaccurate. So I wanted just to point that out also. I think the defense, based on that footnote, also realizes that the date, meaning whether it was 2006 or 2000, is really kind of inconsequential.
Either that or the lawyers and the jury and everybody was totally confused.
Well, let me also point out, based on what you said and a question that Judge McCoy asked earlier, there was evidence admitted. In fact, it's Exhibit 9 to the jury and published to the jury, a hard copy, that tracked the 2000 convictions, and it's part of the record as well. That was admitted for the jury to look at. There was no hard evidence, there was no docket sheet or anything like that regarding a 2006 conviction, but they did have the December 2000 conviction, and it showed when the bond was set and kind of tracked it, and there was evidence that he was arrested again in December 2000 for another DWI. So wanted to clarify that as well.
But couldn't that have even hurt his case? Because then they could have added all the convictions in Exhibit Number 9, plus now another one in December of 06 that didn't even exist. Then you would have gotten up to 7, I believe.
Well, there was no argument that he had 7 convictions. There was an argument that he had 5, maybe 6 convictions. I think that was the line, I think that was the exact words that the prosecutor used, maybe 6 convictions. As I said, there was no objection made at any time to any of that. And I think what we're really talking about here is, and I would argue, harmless, because what we're talking about is, we're not talking about whether he had a conviction, he was picked up for DWI in April, and he was arrested for DWI in December, whether that's 2000, whether that's 2006. We're talking about that he was arrested 2 times in 1 year for DWI. I don't think it's significant if he was on bond or not on bond. And I really think that's what the defense is arguing about in their brief, is the fact that the prosecutor said he was arrested while he was out on bond, if that makes sense.
Are you taking issue with that? I mean, does the documentary evidence that you talked about, the exhibit, demonstrate that one or more of his convictions or his arrests were while he was out on bond from a prior?
Does the document indicate that? Yes, it does. It shows that he was on bond and he was arrested in April. He was put on bond in April of 2000. It shows that the case was not disposed of, I believe, until March of 2001. And the defense certainly doesn't dispute the fact that he was arrested in December, again for DWI. So I think the fact that if he was on bond or not on bond, we argue that he was on bond. I think what's important is that he was arrested and the jury heard that he was arrested 2 times in the same year for DWI. So I really think it's irrelevant whether he was on bond or not. And I would disagree with the defense that the jury was confused as to how many arrests he had, because regardless, the state didn't argue that he was arrested in 2006. We didn't mention that year, and we articulated how many prior convictions he had. We said 5, maybe 6. So they weren't led to believe that he had even 2 additional arrests. Okay, I'm going to go ahead.
5 or 6.
We would argue that he had six, that this was his sixth. But what I'm saying is the prosecutor didn't say to the jury, well, he has eight. Does that make sense, Judge? Okay. I'd like to go ahead and talk about Reagan's argument, the first point of error, the comment on the failure to testify, or what they allege to be a comment on the failure to testify. And if you look at the argument, I know that Reagan talked about it a little bit. I'd like to refer back to that specifically. The prosecutor said, the total refusal, that's what we call it when you don't do any test. No field sobriety test, no breath test. Did you see the defendant that night? He's hoping that you will give him a free pass. If you look at his statement in the context of his argument, he's referring to the defendant's refusal to take the test that night. And it's we're certainly, even as the defense states, we certainly can present evidence that a person refused to take the field sobriety test. To qualify as a comment on the failure to testify, the jury, from the perspective of the jury, they have to believe that this was a comment on his failure to testify. And I think it's obvious from the context of this argument that the prosecutor was referring to his refusal to take the test that night, that night he didn't want to take the test. He didn't want the jury to know, perhaps, that he was intoxicated, as we would allege. That was the evidence that the prosecutor was talking about. I'd cited to some cases also, one of them is Jordan, which is out of this court, where the prosecutor actually said he refused, he didn't want you to know what that reading was going to be, why didn't he want you to know? And this court held that that was not a comment on the defendant's failure to testify, that the prosecutor was talking about that particular night and was referencing the defendant's refusal to take the test that night, that he was commenting on the defendant's failure to produce evidence in the form of a field sobriety test that night, and it was not a comment on his failure to testify. I cited to another case that's very similar to that. It's M. High out of Houston. I thought it was very similar. The prosecutor said, why didn't he do it on video? Because he knew that you would be able to see him on the video. That's why. And that was the same result in this case. That's a case out of Houston, MI. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that right. But the same result. The court didn't see that as a failure or a comment on the failure of the defendant to testify. So, do you have any questions?
Okay, this wasn't raised as a point on appeal, but I have a question.
Sure.
Was anybody injured?
No, a car. He did crash into a car.
Okay, property damage.
A car that was parked stationary.
What is the evidence of deadly weapon? Are we saying that a car is a deadly weapon per se?
I don't think that the law says a car is a deadly weapon per se, but that it, in its manner of use, if it could be, if it's capable in its manner of use of being a deadly weapon, it can be found to be a deadly weapon.
What was the evidence that it was a deadly weapon?
In this particular case, it was about 2 o'clock in the morning. This driver was exiting the highway. There had been a wreck there.
I know.
Yeah, he went around.
Property damage, but what's the evidence that the car in the manner which user intended to use was capable of causing death or serious bodily injury? Was it aimed at people?
I think the evidence was also that there were some police officers there trying to kind of cordon off everything and kind of, you know, keep the area safe. And I think one police officer, and I would have to go back and look at that, but I think he testified that he noticed that the car was kind of going around some pylons and such. And I think I'm not going to say it came close to him or he was hit, because I don't think the evidence would show that. But he did see the car kind of driving in an erratic manner in an accident scene where there were police officers walking around and but the car was stationary and there was not anybody in it at the time. But I think the evidence shows that the car was driving erratically. I mean, it had to go all the way around.
But why isn't there a deadly weapon finding in every single DWI case?
I couldn't answer that, Judge. I'm sorry. I can only talk about this case.
Okay.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you. And other than that, of course, we'll stand on our brief. Thank you.
Mr. Wynn, if in this case the prosecutor had said, he wants you to let him go free, would that be a comment on his failure to testify?
Yes, absolutely. He's the only person that can say what he wants. He's the only person that can supply that evidence. He's the only person who can rebut it. One other thing, at the bottom of page 15 of the state's brief, they state, the prosecutor reminded the jury that appellant had sustained 6 convictions for this offense, reporter's record 535. I think that just goes to show there really is confusion from the record if it's 5, 6, 8, 7, who knows how many. With regard to this argument that you can tie what you see on the video, did you see the defendant that night? He's hoping you. I think you is a really important word, because to buy the state's argument, what you have to say is that he's hoping, as he stands there on the side of the road, that the jury will do something for him, that he knows what the jury will do. Once again, that is purely speculative as to his state of mind. And it not only is speculative, it ties it, I would argue, that argument makes it even more of a comment on the failure to testify, because it ties it to something that is happening in real time for the jury. You got impaneled yesterday. You weren't there a year ago when this offense happened. And by saying you, the prosecutor specifically directs the jury to consider what happened in that courtroom during the trial. The other analogous situation that I think is instructive here is what happens in the motive argument cases. The one that's the best summary is Lopez v. State, 793 Southwest 2nd, 738. It's an Austin Court of Appeals case. And it talks about several Court of Criminal Appeals cases, Lee v. State, Franks v. State, Kohler v. State, and Minton v. State. I think after those cases, it's axiomatic that a prosecutor cannot stand up in a murder case and go, we don't have to prove motive, and you haven't heard any evidence about motive. They say that's a comment on the failure to testify, because the only person who could supply motive for why this happened would have been the defendant, to talk about why he did it or didn't do it. And those cases say you can't do that. Is an improper comment on the failure to testify, and it is a violation of the Fifth Amendment to do it. With regard to harm, I would just point out the first time this case got tried, which was about 10 days before it got tried, the time we're up here on appeal for, the jury hung 6-6. This is a reasonable doubt defense case. This is not a, whodunit, something else. This is a straight reasonable doubt case. The defense argument is the state has failed to prove this beyond a reasonable doubt, and I would argue that by virtue of the fact that another jury hung 6-6, and that is reflected in the clerk's record, that we know it was a somewhat close case about whether or not the state could prove that he was intoxicated while he was operating that motor vehicle. By focusing in such a close case, a reasonable doubt case, focusing the jury on this defendant, his subjective hopes, I mean, effectively what this argument tells me is that defendant's trying to hoodwink you. It directs this jury to this wholly improper area of consideration, and I would submit that in a close case, you can't say beyond a reasonable doubt that it was harmless. And for that reason, we ask that you reverse Mr. Luttrell's conviction and sentence and remand this case for a new trial.
Thank you. Your case is submitted. We adjourn the court.